Hello, this is Melissa, and today is the 4th of August, 2024, and I hope that you are all doing well. The Redux that I have picked to go up is from June 16, 2019, Overlords Call Struggle for Freedom Pathetic, Under Total Surveillance Controls Cybernetic. So last week, I put up the 30th of June 2019, so just stuck around that month and that year for a while. It's a good talk. And there are several things that Alan talks about that I'm going to mention again, and those are Iran, the list. I don't think I need to mention the list. You all know what that is. And Julian Assange and murder, assassinations, and I thought all of these seemed a little bit timely for us. Alan said in this talk that he didn't watch murder mysteries, or he wasn't interested in murder mysteries, and he didn't really understand why people were. And I thought about his enjoyment of Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and so there was that exception. I was thinking about that maybe it was that Conan Doyle had such keen insights into human nature, and that perhaps it was those insights that Alan valued more than whodunit, which he really wasn't that interested in, to be sure. So in Iran, there are a couple of updates that you may or may not be aware of. I'll just share with you. There have been two assassinations. One, Israel has taken credit for, and that is the killing of a top Hezbollah commander, Fuad Shukr, in reprisal for some attacks that happened, I think, about a week and a half ago, in which 12 children were killed and there were other deaths. That happened about, I don't know, maybe 5 days ago now. But one that is the killing of a top Hamas leader, Ismail Haniyeh. So this is from, I think, the ABC out of Australia. Iran vows severe revenge after announcing Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was killed by short-range projectile. Now, there are a couple of different versions of this story. One is exactly that he was killed by a warhead, and they even tell you how much it weighed. They said it was shot from somewhere within Iran, and so that strike took him out. Another version of this story, this is from Axios, planted bomb, remote control, and AI, how the Mossad killed Hamas leader in Iran. The Israeli Mossad assassinated Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh by detonating an explosive device planted in advance in his bedroom at the Iranian government official residence in Tehran. Two sources with knowledge of the issue confirmed to Axios. Why it matters, they say. The fact that the Mossad managed to plant the explosive device in a high-security facility shows not only the deep penetration by Israeli intelligence services inside Iran, but also the vulnerabilities of the Iranian intelligence and security apparatus. The details about the planted explosive device were first reported by the New York Times and confirmed to Axios by two sources. The explosion that killed Haniyeh took place on Tuesday night, but the official announcement of his assassination was published several hours later on Wednesday morning. The initial statement from Hamas said Haniyeh was killed by an Israeli airstrike. Iranian media first reported three missiles were launched by a drone, and later that the missile was launched from outside of Iran. The sources said Israeli intelligence learned which facility and which exact room Haneye stayed in during his visits to Tehran. The bomb was planted in the room in advance. They added that the bomb was a high-tech device that used artificial intelligence. It was detonated remotely by Mossad operatives who were on Iranian soil after receiving intelligence that Haneye was indeed in the room. It goes on to say here that Israel didn't inform the U.S. or any other ally in advance of the assassination, but the sources said that on Wednesday evening, Israeli officials briefed their U.S. counterparts about the detail of the operation. The big picture. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is directly in charge of the Mossad, made the decision to assassinate Haneye. The sources said the negotiations to reach a deal to release hostages held by Hamas in Gaza and establish a ceasefire were a consideration in the decision-making process. One of the sources said the Mossad position was that Haneye's assassination would bring justice to the October 7 attack victims and remove an obstacle to the hostage deal. The source claimed Haneye held a more hardline view on the deal than Hamas leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, and was making it more difficult to get a deal. I was listening to several different sources, interviews with different experts on the region and so on. One of them made the comment about the U.S. knowledge or lack of knowledge in advance of this assassination. They said, if it is true that the U.S. had no advanced knowledge of this, then that's really bad, because it means that a client state of the U.S. just does what it will without consultation. And that doesn't look good. And that's true enough, but it got me thinking, you know, is Israel really a client state? You know, sometimes you have to wonder who is in charge of whom. But then this person went on to say, if they were aware and they did nothing, that doesn't look good either. And then, I don't know if it was on that same program, and forgive me, I won't be able to link to them because I just lost a bunch of pages that I had up, and I really don't have time to go and reconstruct my internet outing for you, but there's a lot of interviews you can find plenty. I always say when you're looking at these kinds of stories, look at it from, if you're interested, look from as many angles as you can. So try to get, you know, the perspective of the country that is being blamed and their allies and their enemies, and just try to see it from as many angles as you can. But one of the gentlemen who was talking made a rather humorous, but, you know, a wry comment. You know, he was saying that if this was part of the negotiation tactic, it was a little lame, to say the least. He said, if you're in the middle of a peace and ceasefire negotiation, is it really a good idea to kill the other side's leader? You know, that kind of would put a halt to the negotiation. And he said, additionally, and this makes sense, he said that he thought that move, whatever hostages remain, that was their death warrant right there. I think I'll just say one more thing about U.S. politics and Iran and the Middle East, because, you know, there is that list, the PNAC, Wesley Clark list that, you know, Alan Watt has mentioned over and over, the seven countries that have to be taken out. And as Alan said in this talk, it doesn't matter if it takes them longer to get the job done, or if they have to regroup with different administrations, they will come back and do it. They will get the job done. So here we have this upcoming election in the U.S. It's going to be between the current vice president, Kamala Harris, and the former president, Donald Trump. And there, I was around some family members, and they have wildly different opinions, and they follow this much more closely than I do. And I always hate it when the politics comes up in any form, because it's like, oh, you know, this was kind of a peaceful moment. I was relaxed, and now it's going to become tense. But fortunately, this rather on-the-nose comment that one of them made didn't draw the kind of ire and anger that I thought it might. But he said about who was going to win or be put it. I think winning and losing when things are so rigged and fixed is not a great way of putting it. But he said that it would be Trump. And the reason why it would be Trump is, he said, you know, Kamala Harris just doesn't have what it takes for American families to sacrifice their sons for Israel. But Trump has that. He's got that fervor that can be whipped up, and people will they'll gladly send their sons and daughters off to fight this war. And that's a very cynical comment, but I think there is a bit of truth there. Just a little aside before I get completely out of away from Trump. In the video that I made last week, I put a little illustration in there. I didn't say anything about it, but I think I will today. I put an image of Mussolini with a big, huge, gigantic bandage across his nose. And just to bring to your attention that he narrowly escaped being assassinated because he just turned his head at just the right moment and the bullet grazed his nose. Alan talks about how assassination is just the oldest thing in the world, and he mentioned all of the different ways that it can be done and sophisticated. And he said way back in the Stone Ages, as it turns out, this is the late 70s, the kinds of methods that they had for assassinating someone were pretty, they were rather James Bond. And he mentioned the umbrella murder, the umbrella assassination. And I've heard him mention that a lot over the years. I mean, quite a few times, but I had never looked into the story, and I was thinking ahead that I might want to put up some pictures or an article about that. And I thought, let's see what this is about. The victim was Georgi Markov, and he was a Bulgarian dissident writer. He was born in 1929, same year as my Aunt Betty. And he died September 11, 1978. He originally worked as a novelist, screenwriter, and playwright in his native country, the People's Republic of Bulgaria, until his defection in 1969. After relocating to London, he worked as a broadcaster and journalist for the BBC World Service, the US-funded Radio Free Europe, and West Germany's Deutsche Welle. Now, a thing about, I didn't have time to look this up, and in fact, it just popped into my head right now, but the U.S.-funded Radio Free Europe, I am pretty sure this is one of these Cold War CIA-funded things that Frances Saunders Stoner, or Stoner Saunders, I'm never sure if I'm getting her names in the right order, but anyway, and the CIA and the Cultural Cold War And that's a bit of propaganda. But then on the other hand, so is BBC. And I'm sure that Germany's Deutsche Welle is as well. Unfortunately, there's really no place else for concerned writers to work, is there? Markov used such forums to conduct a campaign of sarcastic criticism against the incumbent Bulgarian Soviet regime, which, according to his wife, at the time he died, eventually became vitriolic and included really smearing mud on the people in the inner circles. Markov was assassinated on a London street via a micro-engineered pellet that might have contained ricin. Contemporary newspaper accounts reported that he had been stabbed in the leg with an umbrella delivering a poisoned pellet wielded by someone associated with the Bulgarian Secret Service. Annabel Markova recalled her husband's view about the umbrella, telling BBC's Panorama program in April 1979. He felt a jab in his thigh. He looked around, and there was a man behind him who'd apologized and dropped an umbrella. I got the impression, as he told the story, that the jab hadn't been inflicted by the umbrella, but the man dropped the umbrella as cover to hide his face. It was reported after the fall of the Soviet Union that the Soviet KGB had assisted the Bulgarian Secret Service. They don't know if it was ricin in there. His wife, evidently at the time, she just thought that this, you know, the idea that that could be delivered in an umbrella, it was just so far out to her. She was an English woman. And he complained, he showed her that place on the back of his leg. She described it as a hypodermic needle size puncture wound. So very, very, very small. And I think it was that night or early in the morning, he had a temperature of 104. They took him to the hospital. It was said that even if they knew, if it was ricin, there was not an antidote for that. But at any rate, once they retrieved the pellet, there was no trace of poison left in that. I think I'll come back for just a moment to Markov because it was an interesting story. But I'll just mention briefly, Alan talks in this talk about Julian Assange, and he said they'll keep him there forever. You know, he was talking about when you blow the whistle or when you report something that the government does not want it, you know, or the murkiness that we call government doesn't want out there, they will either assassinate you or you will be locked up and silenced in one way or another. And he made the comment that Assange would likely be locked away forever. Well, as it turns out, Assange pled guilty, I think, on one charge, and he was released. And I believe the terms were that he could bypass the U.S. altogether. I think he might have first been sent to Tasmania. I didn't follow it too closely. But at any rate, it appears that he is now in Australia with his wife that he married when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. She's a Swedish-Spanish civil rights attorney. She represented him. They married. She obviously got to have some conjugal visits with him because they have two young children. So pictures that have surfaced of him show him on the beach enjoying the company of his wife and children. So he did get out. One of the other terms of his release was that he would actually have to get rid of everything that he had on WikiLeaks. There were some Hillary Clinton files, and I don't want to talk too much about it because, again, I didn't follow it super closely. So that's all gone now. That doesn't exist on WikiLeaks. He was charged under the Espionage Act of 1917 under U.S. federal law. this act has allowed the U.S. government to charge and convict and execute communists Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. It allowed them to charge the Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who was, I think he subsequently had those charges dropped. The Cablegate whistleblower, Chelsea Manning. Now, if you followed that, you will know that this Chelsea Manning actually supplied these documents to WikiLeaks. And I'm just refreshing our memories a little bit about what happens, who says what, and what happens when you say it or release it or do it. So this was the diplomatic cables leak that began in late 2010 when WikiLeaks began releasing classified cables that had been sent to the U.S. State Department by 274 of its consulates, embassies, and diplomatic missions around the world. They were dated between December of 1966 and February of 2010, and they contained diplomatic analysis from world leaders and the diplomats' assessment of host countries and their officials. So Chelsea Manning was convicted and was imprisoned for 7 years. Her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama. She had served in the army in Iraq as an intelligence, and she was a he. I'm just going to say that. This is a trans person. But since I'm reading an article, I don't want to confuse myself. But Manning had access to classified databases and leaked classified information to WikiLeaks and confided to an online acquaintance that they had done this. This person informed the Army's Criminal Investigation Command, and Manning was arrested. The material included videos of the July 12, 2007 Baghdad airstrike and the 2009 Grenade airstrike in Afghanistan, and all of the U.S. diplomatic cables that I mentioned. This could have resulted in a death sentence, but it didn't. I'm not making a comment or a judgment on did Manning deserve this time in prison? What I am pointing out, though, is that if you look at the Espionage Act of 1917 and the people who were charged under it, they were, for the most part, actual spies or people who actually took something that did not belong to them, whether we want to call them a whistleblower or not. But in the case of Julian Assange, he was a hacker in his youth who had this idea that he was doing something. He was, a white hacker, white hat hacker. And then he founds WikiLeaks, and this is taking things that are given to him. And of course, he'll know that the sources may not be savory, and how they obtained the information that they're sharing may not be have been obtained legally. But what he did was publish it. And what he got for this was extreme punishment and I think persecution by the U.S. government. And mention one other thing about Dr. David Kelly. In this talk, Alan said Dr. David Kelly had died in England in 2003. And Alan said something about he was due to testify in a couple of days. I think that the story actually was that he had already testified. And 2 days after he testified, he was found dead, and this was ruled a suicide. And I bring this up, I'm just going to share with you what it was that he testified on. In 2003, weapons expert Dr. David Kelly was thrust into the media spotlight after being identified in newspapers as the man the government believed was the source for a controversial BBC report on Iraq. The scientist was used to talking to journalists behind the scenes, but he now became a key figure in the row between the government and the BBC over claims Downing Street had sexed up a dossier on Iraq's weapons capability. The BBC report in May of 2003 cast doubt on the government's claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction capable of being deployed within 45 minutes. After he was named in newspapers, Dr. Kelly gave evidence to MPs' committees in which he said he did not believe he was the main source of the story. 2 days after his testimony, the 59-year-old was found dead in a woodland area a few miles from his Oxfordshire home after apparently taking his own life. There was a lot of talk about him being killed, and his wife has maintained all of these years and still maintains that he did take his own life. She said he was distraught by what this meant. It was the end of his career. It was the end of his reputation. He had been publicly vilified, and so she has always maintained that this was a suicide, that is what she maintains. And a group of doctors mounted a long-running campaign for the inquest into Dr. Kelly's death to be reopened, because they said that Lord Hutton, who made the suicide verdict, they said this was unsafe. They complained that Lord Hutton spent only half a day of his 24-day inquiry considering the cause of death, and the claim that there was insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Dr. Kelly killed himself. No coroner in the land would have reached a suicide verdict on the evidence which Lord Hutton heard. They believed Dr. Kelly's wrist wounds were not likely to be life-threatening, making the official cause of death, a hemorrhage, extremely unlikely. So this group of doctors have raised questions that they want answered. Why no fingerprints were found on the knife apparently used to slit his wrist? How he obtained a packet of coproximal painkillers? Why his blood and stomach contained only a non-toxic dose of the drug? Why he was not spotted by a police helicopter with thermal imaging cameras, which flew over the wood where his body was later found? I mention this because going back to Julian Assange and assassination and murder and political intrigue, when I was looking into Assange, I came across an audio interview that had been released 2 or 3 days ago entitled "The Long Shadow of Julian Assange's Conviction." And they discuss really how devastating this is for the future of journalism. And it was quite a good interview, but there was something that was said that really kind of made me go, no, that's not right. And it was the way in which one of the journalists was dealing with the question of Russian interference. There was an inquiry that was done into Trump and his whole administration and whether they had colluded with Russia for Russia to help the Trump campaign get the upper hand over Hillary. And that inquiry, I think it was the Mueller report, said that no, there was absolutely no proof of collusion between Trump or any high-ranking member or anybody that was associated with him and the Russian government. But still, it sticks, this Russian involvement in the campaign, in the election results of 2016. Those are two different things, you know, were they involved in election meddling, or and was Trump and his administration also involved in that? But since we are given the big bad bear, lots of things can be conveniently blamed on them, and you have lots of companies who come forward and say that they, you know, they've proven one way or another that something happened. But we're watching a game of high-level intrigue, and assassination and murder of your enemies is just one part of it. And one of these companies is back in the news. IT investigation company by the name of CrowdStrike just suffered what is called the largest outage of an IT company ever in history. That, you know, so far they're saying that this was, if you all remember, everything just stopped a few weeks ago, air travel, et cetera, because of this outage. That was CrowdStrike. And that they're saying that the minimum damage caused by that is up close to $6 billion, but they're still counting the fallout from that. And CrowdStrike helped investigate the Democratic National Committee cyber attacks and a connection to Russian intelligence services. We're constantly given intrigue, whether it's real or manufactured at a high, high level. And that brought, you know, and then things that don't add up, when you look at them and say that doesn't add up, like, for instance, the murder of Seth Rich. This was called a botched robbery attempt. He was an employee at the Democratic National Committee. You know, if you look in his death, it's all right-wing conspiracies, because Fox News, and they later had to settle with the parents, and other outlets repeatedly said, you know, this leak wasn't Russia. This leak was, you know, ended up on a thumb drive and walked out of there, and then he's dead. And all of this gets fact-checked, and the parents say that anyone who repeats that is a sociopath. And I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened. And it may well have been a botched robbery. But once again, Julian Assange makes that water a little bit murkier, because WikiLeaks offered a reward for anyone who could help solve the murder of Seth Rich, and he went on television and seemed to be implying that the stakes were very high for anybody who leaks information to WikiLeaks. Sometimes I ask myself, is it all theater? Is everything that I'm looking at theater? And that's why I like to look at the human sides of things, even if it's ancient history, and remember the Alan would always talk about during the Cold War, those at the top knew that this was a game. Those at the highest level knew that this was a game. But you've got spies and operatives and agents and bureaucrats, and for them it's all real, and people die. People are really murdered and are victimized by this incredible theater that we live under. And when I was reading up on Yorgi Markov, I was curious about his wife, and I wanted to find out where she was and whatever became of her. I wanted the story to become human. And I'll just read you a little bit here. It said that he had lived in political exile in London since the late 1960s and was married to Annabel Markova, a novelist who writes under the name Annabel Dilk. The couple had a daughter, Alexandra, who was just 2 when her father, then aged 49, was killed. Annabel Markova was younger than him, I think by maybe 15 years. And there was a documentary that was made, and she was quoted at the time she was 70. She said, "I wish that when people talk about it in the West, they wouldn't say, 'Oh, the guy that got stuck by an umbrella,' that they'd say, 'Oh, the great writer, you know, the writer who was so brave that he risked his life to tell the truth.' This would be fantastic." And elsewhere, I found her quoted. She started an award, a prize, the Georgi Markov Prize. And this is from the BBC. I don't have a year on it. It's just a BBC radio program. It's called the International Radio Playwriting Competition. Finding My Voice, Anna Gonzalez Bellows' blog about writing and winning the Georgi Markov Prize. "I write for the International Radio Playwriting Competition, and out of 1,000 scripts from 86 countries, I was awarded the Georgi Markov Prize for the most promising script. 2 years after I finished my studies in London and returned to my home in Mexico, I'm able to come back in style, sponsored by the BBC, staying in a lovely hotel in the center of the city. Promise of 2 weeks with the radio drama department and the World Service. By now, I know about Georgi Markov, and when I meet Annabelle Markova, his widow, at the awards ceremony, I feel incredibly moved. She holds both my hands tightly and congratulates me on being the first winner of this award. When she addresses the room, she says that the reason for this prize to exist is so that people will remember Georgi Markov as more than just a victim of the umbrella murder. Markov was a husband and a father. He was a novelist, playwright, journalist, a dissident writer who spoke out against a totalitarian government, against oppression, and for people's right to freedom of speech." And she was just such a lovely lady in her thought, and a pretty woman, and a woman who loved her husband. And I just dug around. I wanted to find a little bit more. And sure enough, I found her on film. And I'm going to share a link to this. I don't want to tell you too much about it, except if you watch the video, be sure to scroll your mouse over the line that says, the link that says, "Supposed Histories." Because I don't like to blow the ending to a good story. So I'll just leave it there. This is Annabelle Markova telling a story, and it's lovely. And I think that matters to me because, like I say, we live in, as Alan would say, we're mushrooms. We're kept in the dark and fed you know what. And so I always like to seek out what is human. And what I can relate to as being human and loving and even dissidents, even people who risk their freedom and live in an Ecuadorian embassy for years and years and years. They may be flawed people, but what they have risked is their freedom because they believe that we deserve to know the truth. I wish you all a good week, and I will talk to you again. Take care.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 16th of June 2019. I'd like to start off by reminding people to donate occasionally to cuttingthroughthematrix.com website, and I've mentioned it before, you can buy the books and discs on the site, and all the sites listed on cuttingthroughthematrix.com are mine, therefore you'll know they're authentic sites. You should take notes of them all too, in case anything happens to any particular one of them, or even the comm site. And then hopefully you can still get my talks on some of the other sites which I have. Remember too, if you're buying books and discs or donating, they have to be from my sites. Everything else out there who does it and pretends that it's me and but with a different address is obviously someone else that's getting the money. And I say this because it's happened quite a few times before where characters have even reprinted the books and so on. You'd be amazed at the things that happen if you're occasionally hitting the nail on the head and perhaps even frequently hitting the nail on the head. You'll definitely get a lot of problems happening to you. And I've had this for years since I started, actually. So, as I say, for those who can remember I'm still around and who listen to my talks, remember, I can't live on just air. And I need the help too from people to donate for the talks to get. You'd be surprised how many people across the planet use this stuff in all of the big talks. And some of them even in the US too, which whom you know, of course, because they pirate them off, my topics off, and even, often don't even change the writings that I put out there or the way that I word things. And they just repeat them without mentioning where they get them from, and they don't give you a penny, unfortunately. It's a darn shame, but that's the system that we live in today. One thing I've never looked for is this system to be fair, because when you're dealing with humanity, it really is not a fair thing at all. Remember that too. You can look, for instance, at, and I've said this many, many times before, even when you go into the martyrs of history, you even take Christianity, where the people who followed Jesus were booing him once he got caught and he's up there hanging on the cross there. They turned their back because they want a winner, you see. And a winner is someone who's going to make a utopia for them and they do nothing to get it, actually. They want it all for nothing. That's a sad truth that will always be eternal. And you find that over and over again when people are knocked under who've been causing a bit of a problem to different kind of authority figures you might see across the world. They're knocked down more so today because they get more and more bold on simply silencing people. And we all know it. It's rather obvious. And we get little threats, so your internet's not working much at all, or everything starts slowing down, or your telephone calls are all clicking and getting cut off each time you talk to someone. You know darn well you're being harassed, of course. And that's basic, simple harassment. And that's how you hope it stays at that. Yeah, although, who knows? Who knows where it's really going to go? Remember, too, that a lot of the biggies out there that used to be seen as leading proponents for human rights and your rights, too, in your own countries, really are obviously simply political punters today, getting well paid, obviously, to push and promote politics as usual. And even the wars too, as you've all noticed. So I hope you're taking good note of all of that. It's awfully important that you do, if you value your sanity. Because if you don't know who's who today, I do feel sorry for you. It's very, very evident, isn't it? And it's the same with the US too. I have said before that the people in the US didn't have real politicians to vote for in the last election. They really didn't have much of a choice in any party. And it wouldn't really, and I keep saying this, it wouldn't really matter who you got in, if it was Trump or Hillary, because Hillary would take her orders from the same bosses of the planet and would have to go along with it. These are big agendas that were worked out long ago, all the wars, step by step, all the way back to the published lists of the neocons in the 90s, of course. And they haven't changed the list. I keep mentioning the list some generals, too, I've mentioned before, are pretty good at verifying it because they also talked about the list. And we're still living through it, so they never go back on what they plan. They might take a few years to slow down here and formulate their strategy, but they eventually get round to them. And anyone who dares oppose anything today is being put in their place very, very quickly with the very system that people thought was their free system, the internet, which is a big joke. To think that, if you read this, I gave talks in the 90s about this. I never even had a computer then, but I gave talks on the radio. And the only reason I got a computer eventually, a few years later, quite a few years later actually, was because I had to do it for my talks, my shows and things. And that's the only reason, because I knew, and I said that you get 20 years out of if you're lucky. before they rein in all the different rights and freedoms that you thought you had. And that's exactly what's happened, of course. Julian Assange was the obvious martyr to this one, as he did expose a lot of things that were going on and upset the powers that be to an extent. And believe me, if you upset the authorities on that level, they don't forget you, and they won't let you go, and they will get you. You know, the hate it thrives at the higher echelons of power. Hate, if you want real hate, you can just see different characters that they've come to hate down through time. And as always, too, the message is loud and clear that anyone who has a good word to say about Assange is going to get attacked as well. Very obviously. And that's why, of course, they did the arrest the way they did. They publicized it to make sure everybody got the message and terrified every journalist on the planet who might say something good, except for maybe John Pilger, who at least has the gumption to, and a few other people around about him, to come out and say, give some support for Assange. But for the rest of the population across the world, who were quite happy to use his information to their own advantage, of course, for whatever their own personal aims and ambitions were, he had total silence, which is standard again, because Assange didn't bring them the utopia they all wanted. Just a standard thing, isn't it? And that doesn't change. But the message is loud and clear, loud and clear. Their authorities, especially with warfare in mind, are not going to tolerate any little nuisances at all. I'm sure you're all aware that on Trump's recent visit to London, he took some of his top members of government with him. I knew there was more to it going to come out of it. Obviously, it wasn't just going out for dinner with the Queen. It was much more than that. And sure enough, it's to do with this. Are we all on board for the war against Iran idea, obviously, before the supposed, or so we're told, attacks on ships in the Gulf over there that happened supposedly a couple of days ago. They already planned the strategy, obviously, and they were getting, make sure that everybody was on board with it. And that seems to be what they always do. Getting back to Assange, though, I'm sure they discussed that too, because it says here in a newspaper article that a request by the US to extradite Julian Assange has been signed by the Home Secretary Sajid Javid ahead of the court hearing on Friday. So basically, he has to go before a court, and then it's all rubber stamped, of course. Then they'll take him off to the US, no doubt. Even though he's not a US citizen, that doesn't make any difference, does it? And if I remember to all the, for those who can remember, most folk can't remember much today from even a few years ago, because you're hit so fast and furiously with this excess data, often irrelevant data. And often it's very, very true that there are people out there who are meant to take you off into different areas, which are just ridiculous. They're meant to just have you burn up your energies and waste your time. Because if you remember the extraordinary rendition that was going on, where the US was just grabbing people and taking them off to other countries and torturing them, and of course lots of them got killed too and murdered, that's okay. That's okay in our modern lawful society, because we're told that everything's above board, and as long as it's signed into law, you can do all these things, you see, and that's okay. That's the society we live in. I keep saying that nothing has changed. I think Einstein said it too, that nothing has changed when they dropped the bombs, basically, except man's way of thinking. We're still in the Stone Age, basically. Power rules absolutely, and those who have power are generally pretty ruthless characters at the top of all countries, and these are advisors as well in all countries. They're picked because they're psychopathic, and they work their way up because they are psychopathic too. Psychopaths love power. Psychopaths, as I've said before, will serve a top dictator, or even if he's elected, I don't care what they want to call it. It's all the same to me. And they'll serve them very well, and they'll actually almost worship the top person, the person above them, and they'll despise those beneath them. That's the arrogance of the psychopath. That's why they're perfect for the kind of pyramids level from top to bottom of authority. So they love the power themselves. They love to get power, and they worship those who have more power in themselves and despise those with less. Quite simple. Every country's got them. and getting back to Assange, of course, they want to just grab him back to the States or somewhere else. They might ship him some other country. It's astonishing, again, the disclosures a few years after some of the renditions, as he called it before, just where they were putting these people. It's just astonishing, all over the planet. And every country was in the act and grabbing folks and whisking them off to be tortured. And often that was the last you heard of them because they just disappeared, and meaning they're dead, you know. Other ones they can get back, but a lot of them just simply were killed. Because we are so progressive and humanitarian, as they keep telling us, we're more human today. To be honest with you, nothing surprises me, and I don't get so much upset about it because you can't get upset about a system which you understand. Nothing's unexpected. The lies that you get are expected too. Even the types of lies and what they'll be are often expected. But I've never lived in some kind of a fantasy bubble of what the world was. I can remember one show was on years ago. I was with Dr. Stanley Monteith, and he says, "Tell me something about yourself." And he wasn't used to my kind of humor that I have. But I said to him, "Well," I says, "I've often thought of myself as being a bit autistic." And he's a really nice guy, and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that." And I says, no, I says, meaning I was kind of joking about it. But what I was saying was, I said, I tend to see the world as it really is. So that's how I say, I must be a kind of autistic, because most folk don't see the world as it really is. They tend to believe the system that's indoctrinated into them. Many years ago, I gave talks about the system itself and how we're all dozed with this is how to see things. We're dozed with it from childhood. As soon as we're born, your parents are the first ones to indoctrinate you, because they'll try to pass on their indoctrination on to you, thinking it's normal. They tell you what to respect and what not to respect, what's good, what's bad, and so on. It's all changed, of course, in the last 40, 50 years now, as they've turned everything upside down with the big experiment on humanity. And we're always going through literally planned experiments, mass cultures, and for every part of the culture for each century is divided up into sections. And they already have it planned, what type of culture they're going to give you for the next 40 years, for instance. And where you're going, where you are now, and where it came from, and so on. It's all planned that way. And yet the folk who live through that will never know it. They'll think that it's developed that way, and that the choices that they make are their own choices. They have no idea that you're told, here's your handful of choices that you can pick from, right down to even extreme body art, which I might even touch on today. It's all planned for you. So as I say, nothing surprises me. Other philosophers have mentioned it too, through their own observations as well, and their knowledge, acquired knowledge, you get too naturally, that you're living through a system, a very carefully managed system. Nothing's overlooked in the system, especially today with so many levels of government agencies and so many new agencies farmed that are, and the works farmed out from government to them, and think tanks and so on galore. It's just astonishing, working on every facet of society and the future, the present and the future. We truly are like antennas, and every generation is like another crop of antennas, because like antennas receive signals or information or data from sources. And for those who control the sources, obviously, they can decide what kind of data is going to get transmitted. And if the data ends up in a being, a human being, you might say, then obviously the human being is going to believe what they're told, if that's the only source of information that they're fed. And even if they're suspicious about it, they'll find, when they look at other areas or other sources of information, if all verify the same thing, they'll believe it. You see, it's quite easy to do if you monopoly over all information. A very simple thing. But even so, if you've got 10 different establishments, news establishment giving the same stories, then surely they can't all be wrong. But why not? Why can't they all be wrong? We've already done the talks before on, and the studies on the big corporations and consortiums, or call them what you want, monopolies, cartels, who owned the media before, who have their histories published from years ago on how they were started up to be monopolies and to basically standardize information to the people across their continents or their countries. And how effective it's been. It never changes, never will change. And the beauty is that today, of course, it's even better at covering up or trying to hide through a labyrinth of front companies to get to the parent company that actually owns them. And so that's what they do with monopolies, you know. Even if you try to get to split them up and to, from the big massive monopoly that they are, they'd simply hide it even better and better and better. It was so interesting watching a documentary put out there on Standard Oil, basically, and the oil wars that happened in the early 20th century. You find that they had a monopoly on information then too, and they also were in the business of buying up newspapers to standardize information. It wasn't just oil they wanted to own and standardize all of it. They wanted to own everything pretty well. And they believed in a system that would not be democratic, that really was the right, is a right for big billionaires, the richest folk, to run the world. That's what they really believed. And they were more open about it than they are today. The only ones they had to trick and confuse were the general public beneath them. And they're awfully good at that too with their medias. Because the old man Rockefeller himself said that competition is a sin. And it wasn't just being facetious. He meant it. And don't forget too that the Rockefellers were in touch with, they were really the beginnings of the American branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is the Council on Foreign Relations, who wanted to take over the resources of the world. They were already doing it from Britain. I hate even using the term Britain because the British folk hadn't got a clue what went on. They just paid for it all through their taxes and their wars and so on. But and supplied the troops. But the Royal Institute for International Affairs, it came from the Lord Alfred Milner Group, who ran the British Empire. Milner's group were the top people who ran it in the top positions for the Empire. But they also, the members also ended up running the gold mines and the diamond mines across Africa and much of the resources across India too. And they did not believe that democracy was a thing which was a safe, viable system for the public either. They believed that they would give the appearance or the semblance of a democracy. They allow you to vote and make you think that you're free and so on. It's awfully good. But these organizations are still going on, alive and well today, but they're still going after all the resources of the world. They never ever went back on that or changed their minds on it, because that's essential for them to own all of the resources in the world. And it isn't just like accumulating wealth and more wealth and more wealth so they can hold on to power and then have arranged marriages amongst their families to keep hold of that power and wealth. It was also to basically bring in their system, which we know today as progressivism, where science and so-called the humanist scientists would rule the world on their behalf. They would be the kind of technical class on the behalf of those who owned all the resources. And this has all happened. It's all happened. And all the think tanks too that work for them too are part of the scientific groups which give the customs and the culture to each up-and-coming group of, say, 10 years apart. They hit them further with what's going to be their culture and their culture and their culture right up to the present. It's very clever. It's not so difficult to understand. It really isn't. It's just difficult if you've never heard about it before. It kind of shocks your mind. But it's quite easy to understand how it's actually done. And it's not guesswork on my behalf here, as I've said before, Lord Bertrand Russell wrote enough books about it. He worked with the Macy Group, awfully important, to do with the technocrats and so on, which would be the expertise of the scientific staff that would run the world, how we do it all, how to give cultural changes step by step until within a 40-year span, those who were hitting 20 would think it was all quite natural and normal. That's how you know, precise it is. Very, very effective. And if you look back to, for instance, the world wars that really initially made no sense, especially World War One, to the population. But now, of course, as I've said before, they always disclose a lot of information after 50 or 100 years that previously was under the Official Secrets Act in the UK, for instance. And they tell you far more about why it all started in the first place. But it was never for the reasons they told the public. The public is told that those people were going to fight. They're really bad people. They're evil people. And they're monstrous people. And we have to fight them for the good, the greater good and all that. And that's what we do. We often fight them. All countries are given the same propaganda. But they're never told the real reasons, the true reasons for all. And of course, even change is one of the big reasons for it. We plan change. To get change going in a dialectic, you must have at least two opposing parties. If they're not in opposition, you won't get change. They'll be quite happy to go along in harmony. So you create division and get them fighting with each other, and then you plan the outcome from whoever's going to win it. You plan the outcome to be changed, to change the world. That's your synthesis, basically. Very simple, but very well directed and very well coordinated. World War One, again, too, the propaganda was simple. At the end of that war, the bankers themselves attended, who helped draft up the treaty. And, of course, they put Germany under such stiff penalties to pay off reparations to all countries involved that they could never have paid it off. And then you had the Great Depression, and it didn't help at all. And of course, Germany had it even worse because they got runaway inflation. It's old hat, all that stuff now. But it was caused by the treaty after World War One, guaranteeing another world war because Germany had to fight its way out or basically die. And the top writers or journalists who attended the Versailles Treaty and then the Paris Treaty agreed with that too. They actually published books on that. They said this is a big, big mistake. There's got to be a better way. But again, World War II came along, and then everybody's fighting for their way of life and so on. The same propaganda. But look at it today. Look at it from even World War One and World War II makes no difference. The grandchildren of these soldiers and so on literally have been taught to hate their countries and their own people. That took planning, and it didn't happen by itself. It took a lot of work and a lot of indoctrination, very clever indoctrination, almost psycho-indoctrination. It's like psychotherapy, only it's to give you a whole new way of seeing something until you hate it. As you shape it, you can shape a culture, you understand. You can shape the mindset by selected material. And with the exclusion of, say, other parts of the story. And so it's not that hard to do at all, really. And I've often said, too, that if you were told to go off and fight for something in a physical war, and you're given scary, scary, terrifying stories as to why you must go and do it, don't do it, because I guarantee it's got nothing to do with it telling you. And if you succeed to then live through it, you'll find if you have children at all or grandchildren, they probably end up hating you or even want to exterminate you because of their indoctrination. It's quite easy for it to be done, actually. We're used and abused in the system. We truly are. And those who bring you near to the ultimate goals of those who rule, and there are definitely goals, indeed, these people might eventually one day publish more on what they've done to bring you to the step or the stage. And by that time, of course, if they ever tell you, it's because you couldn't do anything about it anyway. Or you might even like it. It's quite easy to love servitude, like Aldous Huxley said. You come to love your servitude. It's not that heavy. It might be quite happy, actually, with lots of cheap or free entertainment, things like that. That's why we're catered to so much today. That's why, too, they allowed so much pornography on the internet in the first place. We live in a system, if they want to shut you up, they do it very quickly. We live in a system, if they want you to stop drugs flowing, it would have happened very, very fast. And you wouldn't have scandals coming out like drugs for gun scandal, like the Contras that came out in Reagan's time with Oliver North. Drugs were essential to sell at the time for the CIA's different plans or black budgets and so on to supplement. And of course, to make a lot of folk rich. Nothing happens by itself, but it generally never happens for the reason you're told. It never does. And each thing you do, each war you fight for what's called this new order of things, or like Bush said, and Bush Jr. said the same thing, they call it the new world order. Each time you get closer to it, or the next level of it, you've lost more and more rights along the way. It's not for you. It's a world order of their dreams. They've dreamt for this world order for so long in certain select organizations, like the clubs, like the Royal Institute for International Affairs, or the CFR, and higher groups above them too, which are circles within circles, as you say, they overlap on the extremities. Much like what you see when you see the Olympic flag with the circles all joined together. That's circles that join, you know, the circles of friends, circles of influential friends in power, and they're all joined together. That's how it's done. Different names for different parts of them, different rings, but they all know the big plan, they all work towards it in their own select specialized areas. That's how it's done. But when you look at what's happened, if you live long enough to see what's happened in your own lifetime, you'll shake your head, because most folk live through it without seeing it coming, you might say, or adapting to it without even consciously questioning it or wondering why these things happen. And you hope, okay, before they die, maybe the pen will drop, and I'll say, my God, then it was planned this way. But that's how it happens, as I say. Remember, World War One was a big plan. H.G. Wells talked about it, Fabian Society, Bernard Shaw, many others, talked about that their dream would get fulfilled through this war, this war to end all wars. They came out with these slogans, you see. And of course, it never was a bigger lie than that, the war to end all wars. But the war was to get everybody to their knees, to give up sovereignty. But out of it came the League of Nations. That was the beginning of it. Of a world government. H.G. Wells talked about it openly. He wrote about it and said this is our hope and dream come true. Now politicians or bureaucrats mainly, they really run governments, regardless of politicians. The bureaucrats are more important. They're technicians. They know their area, their field of expertise, and they run it. But he said that now the heads of those organizations can contact each other and work together and bypass the political system altogether. Well, when you look at all the treaties that have been signed and agreements that have been signed through United Nations, they came out of the League of Nations, and everybody automatically goes to sign the latest thing that they want you to do. And we don't get to vote for the United Nations, so why are your representatives signing on to these foreign things in the first place? Most of you won't answer a question or even question that, but the fact is, your politicians are fronts. They are front people. And they know not to ask questions. That's how they get up there. People in politics clue in quickly what not to ask from anybody higher up the totem pole. And that's how you get up the ladder. That's how they're selected. And politicians do what they're told. Their scripts are written for them. All of them. When they come in front of a television set of news time, it's public relations exercises. And everyone's put up in place, and the little place where they stand and the whole thing, and there's a speech there for them, and they power off their speech written by somebody else, and that's what they do. That's what they do. And they'll sign their name to anything they're told to sign their name to by their bosses. Because they do have bosses. It's true enough, you know, that some of them don't know they've got bosses, or they tend to forget it. Like Ronald Reagan, he got shot. Not to kill him, but he got shot to remind him that he wasn't the boss. at one point. That's how it goes. If you look across the world, like in India, occasionally you'll see someone getting blown up at election time on some standard where they're giving a talk or something like that. That's happened. It's more common in those countries because they're not so camouflaged as to how they get around things. Getting back to my point of some originally, humanity hasn't changed. Systems of government and governing, you might think more complex, but they're not. You have the strong psychopaths at the top who are not wielding clubs anymore, you see. They use military and use policemen to do their, and they use other agencies as well to do dirty works for them. And every country does dirty work. Every country. No exceptions. None of them are squeaky clean. They all have their dirty trick squads. All of them. And they are used. And the thing is that they'll always point to across the water, as I say, or somewhere else, like India, and they'll say, oh, look at what's happened over there. But is this because it's more blatant over there? We don't get so many things in the West, like blowing up politicians so much today. But if they can get away with it, they've got more subtle ways of dealing with things. And believe you me, there's just as many people in the West being bumped off and assassinated and having accidents. We're accidented. That's what happens to us all the time in the West. Very, very sophisticated and often put down to natural causes or whatever it happens to be, or hit and runs or drive-by shootings and so on. That's so common. And it's only your disbelief, you see, that allows it to continue. And it does continue. A few years ago there were top biochemists just dropping dead all over the place and just falling over, you know, real banisters of tall stairs, and so just falling over them, just things like that all the time. Involved in certain projects, naturally. Big, big field. The top investigators to do with Kelly in Britain that was killed just before he was going to testify. He said he'd be found too, the scientist. He says, he warned, he said, I'll be found dead in a field with my arms slit, you know. And he was. This happens in the West. We've got to stop thinking we're so advanced. Really. That they would never do that. What do you mean they? They would never do it here. They do it all the time. We've got to get that through our heads. Really. You know. If you look at Assange, the guy was petrified. He didn't stay inside the Ecuadorian embassy because he liked the wallpaper. The man knew that they'd kill him. And if they couldn't kill him, they'd do what they do now, which is the next best thing. They might kill him yet. Which is to put him away for natural life. As a big, big warning to everybody else. So he'd be the ultimate scapegoat for everybody else, you see. He's a sacrificial lamb, you might say. That's what it is, really. And a warning. And believe you me, all the reporters out there have got the warning loud and clear. And they're all complying. They're all immediately with this Iranian thing. Oh my, oh yes. And they're publishing the handouts given to them by the military and by their governments. Just poof, poof, poof. Just like 9/11, before the dust was even, I think before the buildings actually have collapsed completely, they're already yelling to tell you who to blame for it. Same thing, same technique. And they tried it a few years ago and blamed Iran for the same kind of things. And they found, when they showed you the photographs, somebody managed to get the photographs of the ships that were hit before, not this time, but before. And you saw that the explosions definitely were from within the ships because the plate ceiling was blasted outwards. You know, you get these shards with the blast outwards and you see quite clearly. But this time, they're trying to say, of course, that Iran even used torpedoes, which is ridiculous because torpedoes would have hit just below the waterline. And these particular, the things they saw were just above it. And so they're claiming it's limpet mines now, but it still doesn't wash because It's the same scenario as Syria. Syria was warned that if you used chemicals, we're going to bomb you. That was the, and that's what was used against them over and over, even though they hadn't used them. And even the British attaché to the country over in Syria said that too. It was all bogus. That they're getting blamed for. Well, it's the same with Iran here too, because Iran would have nothing to gain by inviting war upon them at this moment. Nothing to gain. And again, Iran too, since Japan had a cordial visit to Iran at the time this happened, of course, and the Prime Minister of Japan was there, why would Iran, who was home to do trade and even sell oil to Japan, why would Iran then go and sabotage its own work? It makes no sense, you see. You always say, who does benefit? Well, the fact is, it was on the cards. And we live in a time of dirty tricks. And we always have lived in a time of dirty tricks. That's the real world, folks. It really is that bad. It truly is that bad, you know. And you know, only if you live in Disneyland and your indoctrination has been awfully, awfully well taken by your body and your system and your brain, will you ever believe anything different. I can remember years ago when the Cold War was on the go, and there was a Russian defector to Britain living in London at the time, and he was coming down an elevator, and this is what they pieced together. In the elevator travelling down was another guy with an umbrella, which is in common in London, and a befurled umbrella. And the defector, the one who was a defector, got out the elevator on the street, walked up a few feet and then dropped dead. It had been put down to natural causes, like a heart attack or something like that, and that'd be the end of it, except for one person in the mortuary who had a good look, a minute look around at the body, and for a tiny, tiny, like a, almost like a mosquito bite, smaller than that even. It wasn't up and raised, it was just a tiny little thing on the back of a calf of the leg. And sure enough, they fished around and dug out a tiny, tiny, it was like a miniature BB pellet, and a BB pellet small enough, tiny little thing. And under a microscope, they showed you it in the newspapers. It had little holes in it, and that's where this particular poison would come out of. And they deemed that a person was in the elevator with him and just touched him on the back of the leg, it'd be gas and driven, you know, like an air gun sort of thing, and driven into him. He probably didn't feel much at all, if anything, you know. And that was that. That was his death warrant right there. They had an idea immediately who this other person might have been, because London had a fantastic watcher system, they call it, where anybody from any interesting countries were followed in incredible detail 24 hours a day. So they pretty well knew who it would have been. Sure enough, when they got to the person's flat, he left behind belongings, this hitman, and they showed you a briefcase, which was a standard assassin's briefcase, with a whole bunch of vials and sprays and injections and things like that. And they said, now this is way back in the year, in the caveman's days, I suppose. But they said that there were poisons in there, which were standard across the world of espionage and assassination, which could mimic all kinds of diseases, like fast-acting cancers, fast-acting cirrhosis of the liver in a teetotaler, for instance, things like that, very quickly. And under just general autopsy, or post-mortem, as they say in Britain, autopsy, they probably pass as the actual real thing most of the time. That was then. So you understand, the assassin's trade is very old. It's about as old as prostitution, I suppose. It's so old, way, way back in time. Way back in time. It was rife during the Roman days too, when poisons were used to assassinate different nuisances in the political realm. Nothing changes. And I say humanity really hasn't changed, except they've got more sophisticated techniques of propagandizing us on a daily basis through media. And, of course, the electronic instant communication system. We're all getting the same data across the planet at the same time from the same sources. Very powerful indeed. And I also remember, too, there was a group of assassins that attacked, they were after Arabs, and I don't know if the guy was Palestinian, but he was Arab. They classified him as Arab, and he was a leader, and he was hauled off into into a doorway from a street and squirted in the ear with the deadly poison. They pretty well knew who it was. Luckily, his team were around him at the time. He knew exactly what it probably would have been, and they got him right to the hospital for the proper antidote. And this stuff would penetrate your eardrum. You'd have no symptoms otherwise, except for everybody who saw it happen. And you go into basically a coma, and then you'd die. And it'd probably put down to cerebral hemorrhage or something like that, you see. And but that was a few years ago that happened. It was in the newspapers. And then you find that was the same thing from Shakespeare. He talked about that type of poisoning through the ear that had been used on in Hamlet's father. I think it was that one. So anyway, as I say, it's a fascinating study to see how horrific humanity can be. And in every generation, there are people who are quite willing and happy to kill people. They enjoy it. And so they can do it legally. For governments and what they call good causes. Quite something, isn't it? And yet, I mean, and everybody's so fascinated by murder stories. I've never understood the fascination by murder stories. Maybe it's because folk really do wish they could kill certain people through their life. I don't know. But I've never been interested in whodunits. But I'm more interested in the real life assassinations that happen all the time. All the time. Because we live in humans, their nature has never changed. You understand that? Never changed. And those who seek power, it never changes either. Never does. It's a pretty nasty world. And when you realize, too, the change agents of teachers and education, and that's what they're called nowadays, because they do, each teacher knows that they're really there to change the culture through indoctrinating the children. Nothing to do with teaching them to be able to support themselves and throughout life. Nothing, that's out the window today. But they come out all with politicized, don't they? They come out knowing what is right, what's wrong, and all the new normals, which are okay to do, and what they should do, and so on, what they shouldn't do. It's all taught to them through school. There's never been such a time of mass indoctrination and with perfected techniques made by psychologists and behaviorists and neuroscientists. They make up teachers' toolkits. They make sure they can bring them all from a beginning on any topic in a circle to the perfect ending and have them all believing in the version you've just told them. That's how perfect it is today. So getting back to the system. You can see the velvet gloves coming off the iron fist. Today, as everybody gets the message, to be good, to shut up, and to talk about space aliens and things that are okay to talk about. Things like that, you see. That's what they want you to do. Now, one hears, Australia may be the world's most secretive democracy. Well, there's no democracy, really. It's the same agenda as all the rest of us. And it says, I mentioned last week about them invading journalists' homes because they had reported supposedly on some special forces in Afghanistan who'd been doing untoward things, you might say. They weren't just doing their job. Supposedly, that was the rumor at the time. But it says one journalist is being investigated for reporting that several boats filled with asylum seekers recently tried to reach Australia from Sri Lanka. So reporting on things now, when you're told to shut up, is in the open now, you see. Another reporter had her home raided by authorities this week after reporting on a government plan to expand surveillance powers. There on Wednesday, the Australian Federal Police showed up at the public broadcaster That's the main station, basically, with a warrant for notes, story patch, pitches, emails, and even the diaries for entire teams of journalists and senior editors, all in connection with a 2017 article about Australian Special Forces being investigated over possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The aggressive approach which Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison has defended fits with a global trend. And democracies from the US to the Philippines are increasingly targeting journalists to ferret out leaks, silence any critics, and punish information sharing. And that's often important. If you share this information, you're going to get it coming down on you, basically. With President Donald Trump leading the verbal charge by calling journalists the enemy of the people. What does he mean by what people is he talking about, though, eh? Huh? Enemy of the people? That's a term which is used in communist countries. See, slogans can be used in all tyrannies, can't they? But M the people, yeah, there you go. I saw an article in a paper that I thought about there when I just read that. It was in Hong Kong, because mainland China wants to extradite people from Hong Kong that harbors a lot of discontents and malcontents that from the communist regime, and China wants them over to deal with them, obviously. And some of the signs they had up, the protesters in Hong Kong, were for the police, who were firing all kinds of nasty things at them during demonstrations. And these signs in English, some of them, said, "Don't be an enemy of the people." So now here's Trump saying to journalists, "You're the enemy of the people." He said, "But even amongst his peers, Australia stands out. This is no other developed democracy holds as tight to its secrets," experts say. And the raids are just the latest example of how far the country's conservative government will go to scare officials and reporters into submission. It isn't just conservative. Never fall for this left, right wings. The same agenda goes on regardless of who is the front person in power at the time. And he says, "To be perfectly frank, this is an absolute international embarrassment," said Johan Lidberg, associate professor of journalism at Monash University in Melbourne, who works with the United Nations on global press freedom. "If you're a mature liberal democracy that pursues and hunts down whistleblowers and tries to kill the messenger," it says. Anyway, it's getting worse and worse, obviously. We're back into the old nasty system, eh? And you're all getting the message that the internet's not yours. But you can still, I suppose, go and see porn and all that stuff that they got you addicted to in the first place. They made you to watch for it and want to have computers, you know, personal computers with privacy. Personal, it's your personal computer. Meanwhile, half the planet spying on you through your personal computer, which you should really be given for free. I said that from the beginning. It's the biggest spy agency that Ms. Tuller is. They should be giving it to you for free. Your government should do that. And then you get into the agenda I've mentioned before of depopulation. What do you think sustainability means? See, you see, it's about population control and bringing it down fast. Sustainability. I've gone through that in many articles over years from the big sources, the foundations, the think tanks that they use, the United Nations Department of Population that was set up for the UN by the Rockefellers, by the way. They're all interconnected, one system, you see. But you're all the problem. And any excuse will do, so they hit on, you know, sustainability and carbon and all that nonsense, you see. And that's why you're heavily under attack, and you're going to go into massive austerity. And once they bring the next big financial crash in, which is planned, of course, everything's planned. With a money system that's, when the money's backed on nothing, they could keep the fantasy going forever if they want to. I want to just put in two tonight, the warfare techniques that every country's in. We all have our little plans on what-if strategies to do with invasions or wars with whoever. But here's one, it came out of RT, actually. This is Meddling 101. U.S. Army Research Center publishes strategy to destabilize Russia. It's quite fascinating to read it because that's exactly what they're doing, including causing mass migration into it from countries around about them, if need be, and the techniques of how to do even that. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Huh? So U.S. Army soldiers take part in a NATO training exercise, blah, blah, blah. And it says, the US could use a variety of economic, military, and ideological strategies to overextend and unbalance Russia. Well, that's what you do, overextend it with mass migration, medical care, they need medical care, and then the taxation galore to pay for more accommodation to put up even all the masses of refugees. These are destabilization techniques. If you haven't figured that out, it's all done on purpose in the West too, including the darn wars. And I was thinking about it when I was reading this article too, and even before it happened with Iran, or coming up with Iran. You understand the mass migration you're going to have with all the other countries involved. Syria too. They won't stop just at Iran. They want Syria out the way too. They won't forget them. And you get millions more folk flooding into Europe, and people can't afford it. It's meant to destroy and destroy and destroy. Of course it is. A complete massive shake-up of everything that was, a destruction of everything that was, bringing in chaos. Now with the chaos, you bring in the new order. That's what it's about. So I'll put this article up too, there's a PDF for it too. It shows you, this is the US Army Research Center, their think tank on strategy. All the ways to bring them down. And you can bring it all the other countries down with it too, because obviously it's been used already, all these techniques in other countries. It's quite fascinating, right? It says, geopolitically, the report offers that US could consider more lethal aid to the Ukraine to fight, you see, Russia, the proxy wars, but acknowledges this option could lead to much wider conflict. Increasing US support to Syrian rebels is another option. See, US support to Syrian rebels. These were the ISIS rebels against Syria. Increasing it. See, they've already been funding them up until now. This is, but could result in similarly unsavory outcomes, including damaging efforts to combat Islamic terrorism. No kidding, eh? The US could also try to reduce Russian influence in Central Asia, promote uprisings in neighboring states, and flip Transnistria, and expel Russian troops from the unrecognized, mostly Russian-speaking region that broke away from Moldova after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. However, the authors resigned themselves to the fact that much of these options, most of them would be difficult to carry out and could prove costly to the US and may not even have the desired effect. Militarily, the US could reposture its bombers within easy striking range of key Russian strategic targets in order to raise Russian anxieties. So that's what they've been doing with the bases around and missiles around Russia for quite a few years. There's on and on and on of all the techniques that can be used, but yeah, it's quite amazing to see these things. But the PDF is quite fascinating for those who want to read it. All countries will do this, so they always have these what-if scenarios. That's like 3 days of the Condor, it was called. That was along that lines of what they planned with their war games and so on. Also, Google staff keep a blacklist of conservative and fringe sites. Fringe sites is stuff that writes, it just watches and notices what's happening. And they don't want them to maybe wake up people to what's happening. That's really your fringe site, you see. They don't care about ones that are, they think they're UFOs or folk who think they're aliens. They don't care. But if you just put two and two together in an understandable way, you're a problem. Like Bertrand Russell said, you would be. And they'd have to eliminate you, basically. That's what Russell advocated. If you couldn't buy them over and win them over, you'd have to eliminate them, such people. Anyway, it says the lists allows Google employees, and the links here for the lists, who CEO Sundar Pichai told Congress in December, never manually intervene on any particular search result to suppress certain addresses and users' search results. And the Daily Caller claims to have seen screenshots of the list in question. Google did not address whether its staff deliberately weed out certain political content, but did say they are working to filter out inappropriate search results. So there you go, you're just blacklisted. You won't be, no one's going to hear you or whatever, eh? Or find your sites. Eh? The first list is titled Web Answers URL blacklist and let staff block specific web addresses from popping up in Google's featured snippets when a user asks a question. Many of the pages blocked are op-ed articles, which a user could mistake for straightforward news reporting. This list appears to target opinion pieces in general, regardless of their political bent. So there you go. It's like lawyers of all kinds. They even have some people blacklisted under the same blacklisting as they would do with a religion, for instance, anything to do with Christianity especially. And they can put you down as almost pornographic because you in the same category if you have any good things to say about Christianity. No kidding, yes, this is where it's all gone, isn't it? So fringe content will come as no surprise to some. The company, along with a bevy of others like Silicon Valley tech giants, has been accused of harboring a liberal bias for several years now, with new stories of favoritism surfacing regularly. And to give you more data, more links to further studies, etc., etc., etc. But get used to it, it's just going to get worse. What can you do? You expect it. And folk will stay on the internet, like I said, because once you get hooked on the pornography and all the stuff you're hooked on, most folk will just continue using it. I gave that talk in the 90s about what happened. Exactly, it's happened exactly that way, you know, absolutely that way. Yeah, definitely. Now, Britain's on board, like I say, with the crew that were over with Trump to meet the British Parliament and with royalty and so on. Obviously, it's meant to get Britain totally on board and to do with Assange, etc. But it says Jeremy Hunt of Britain warns Iran of unintended but catastrophic consequences over attacks on Gulf tanks as he backs America's claim that Iran is responsible. There you go. Groundhog Day. You keep waking up to Groundhog. You've heard it all before, haven't you? And then suspicion doesn't begin to describe what happened. Iran's FM on tanker attacks. As a foreign minister on tanker attacks in the Gulf of Oman, he just says suspicion doesn't begin to describe what happened. Well, there you go. And Pentagon seeks to build global consensus on Iran. Is it time to worry, it says. I'll put that up as well. This is where we are, folks, with all this, isn't it? It's so boring. We've seen it all before. The same build-up, the same characters, the same lines. It's boring stuff, really. Yeah. That's the times in which we live. But I'm sorry to bore you all tonight. If I bored you, I didn't mean to. Just that, yeah, I'm going to get any real news anymore. I've said that for quite a long time now because everyone knows what they can and can't do. And most of the news you get now is totally irrelevant and nonsensical. It fills the spaces on the newscasters, papers, or whatever they use today. Screens, I guess, but yeah, I'm going to get any real news. Because everyone's scared. Everyone's afraid. That's when everyone should be afraid. It's when the people are afraid of government. Well, you've heard it all before, eh? From myself, Alan Watchman, to Canada. Stay well and hope your God or your gods go with you.